Once a favorite of just about everybody in America, the Blenheim apricot lost out in the race to industrialize our food chain. Then, a few short years ago, two young men in Silicon Valley discovered a Blenheim tree filled with ripe apricots. And now the race is on to eat them to save them. This leads us to ask, why should we save the Blenheim apricot?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 555th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Sasebo who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. With the Daves out there in the engineering compartment,
we have two Daves, no waiting, Michael.
Two Daves, no waiting. Well, welcome both of you, and thank you for being there today. Also, we have Carol Stafford.
Hello.
Parmley Taff.
Hello.
And Marlene Olson.
How do you do?
Folks, welcome to part two of a two-part series on bread and jam. This series was inspired by a story included in my new book, Tales from a Tin Can, which is an oral history of a World War II Navy destroyer. In Tales from a Tin Can, Robert Olson, who is my father, tells a story about bread and jam that made me very hungry for the kind of foods we used to eat before we learned how to manufacture cheap foods. Their story takes place in the Bering Sea. For those of you who are geographically challenged, the Bering Sea is due west of the great state of Alaska and above the Aleutian Islands, out there in the very, very cold and storm-laced part of our world. It is the place where they film the deadliest catch, for those of you who catch those things on television. So you can pretty much see it's a pretty terrible place to be. And my father's ship, the USS Dale, was stationed in the Bering Sea for 9 months in 1943, and of that 9 months, only 12 hours were spent ashore. My father's job on that ship was to make the steam that propelled the Dale through those terrifying seas. He worked nights, but that didn't seem to make any difference in the winter because there really weren't days at all. Also aboard the Dale was an Amish baker named John Overholt. And every night, Overholt would bake Navy bread the Amish way for the next day's mess. Father tells how he became very adept at sneaking up to Overholt's galley in the middle of the night and stealing a couple of loaves of bread and taking them back to his mates down in the fire room. So down below, those thick slices of still hot bread would be slathered with butter and jam and then feasted on as the Dale plowed through the Arctic night. So delicious was Overholt's Navy bread baked the Amish way that the guys down in the fire room soon became known around the ship as the fire room fat boys. Now, I also had a mother who used to bake, and so know how delicious that fresh-baked bread can be. But for years, it's been industrial breads and jams, which simply do not satisfy the way those real foods did. And thus, this mini-series on bread and jam. Last week, we featured Daniel Leader, who is the author of Local Breads, and a baker in baker-in-chief of Bread Alone. And would you go get our other guest? Yeah, there you go. And this week, we're going to talk jam, Blenheim apricot jam, with Phineas Hong, who is one of the founders of We Love Jam. Now sit up right, pull that mic down. There you go.
All right, hello.
There you go. So welcome aboard. First time on the radio?
The very first time.
Well, good. We Love Jam. Blenheim apricots. How on earth did all of this start?
That started with my mother's backyard, actually.
Okay, good. Also with us, the co-founder, Eric Haberle. Eric, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hello.
Good. The reason there's a lot of shuffling around, folks, is that we have had a feast here today. Absolute wonderful feast. Last week after we did the bread show, we all thought we have to bring some breads in. So we had a bread baking contest, which was won by Parmley and Carol. Our local bakery came in a close third or second, as you will. And the jam boys from We Love Jam brought in their apricot jam made from the Blenheim apricot. And I'll tell you, we've just been feasting like you wouldn't believe. We have all of these beautiful breads, cheeses, butters, and this beautiful, beautiful Blenheim apricot jam. So there's a lot of shuffling going along, drinking espresso, drinking coffees. Gosh, it's been fun. And you guys are responsible for the jam part of this. Mm-hmm. And so last week we did bread, and today we did do jam. So we'd like to hear a little bit about how you became involved in jam, because this is a lot different than most jams that you can find in the world, right? Eric, start us off. How did you get involved in doing jams? Are you always a jam maker?
No, it was a complete accident. We basically were in the south of France on vacation, and what town was that?
Grasse.
In Grasse, which is actually the perfume capital of France, and that's where all the perfumes, all the flowers were grown.
Oh.
And so we thought it'd be fun to stay there. As soon as we got to the town, you could see it like in 5 minutes. They're like, oh, we're stuck here for a whole day. What are we going to do? So we asked for a restaurant. We went there, and long story short, we had a white peach dessert that was unbelievable. And so when we went back, when we came back to the U.S., we were in his backyard.
Yep.
And I hadn't been back there before, and we saw a tree with some fruit on it. I'm like, what's that? And he goes, oh, that's an apricot tree. I'm like, well, what do you do with the fruit? And he goes, well, my mom eats it, and the rest of it kind of falls on the ground and rots.
Which is what happens with a lot of fruit trees in the world when it gets right down to it, right?
So I said, well, let's make some jam. So we picked up a bunch of the apricots, and we cooked it up. And when we were cooking it up, what all I can say is that white peach dessert served as our inspiration.
Uh-huh.
And the rest is history. But for the past 5 years, we've been making it every year, just giving it away to friends and family. And people really, really were crazy about it. And on a lark, I sent a press release to Food & Wine Magazine and Savour saying that there's this exclusive jam. We only make 100 jars a year. And, you know, I sent them a sample. And we didn't hear from them for almost a year. And then in November, last November, we got a call like, oh, we want to write about you guys. We need all this information in the next, like, 48 hours. And so they did an interview and asked some questions, and then the thing came out. When was it?
February, I think.
February of 2007 of this year. Yep. And we built a little website, and we said that they could buy it on the website, and we had no preparation for, like, the response. Like, thousands of emails, all these people wanted to buy this stuff, and we're like, oh, what are we going to do? We, you know, we can't make this much from our one tree. And so basically, we started doing research, trying to find some local orchards that grew the Blenheim. Because we didn't know what kind of apricot it was at first. Yeah. And we did some research, and we went on the slope.
So it was just an apricot tree.
It was just an apricot tree, you know. And so we did some research and basically found out it was a Blenheim. And so we're calling some orchards. And the first guy I called up called me back and goes, well, I don't have any Blenheims anymore. I tore up all the trees. It's an unprofitable crop. But I can give you names of a few farmers who still grow it. And so I called a couple of farmers, and you know, they said they grew it, and I guess we bought some extra fruit for our second mailing list. The first batch of our jam was from our tree, and then the second batch was from the Van Dyke Orchard, which is in Gilroy, which most amazing fruit.
Now, let me ask you a little bit about, well, first let me introduce our other guest, Poppy Tooker, from Slow Food USA in where, Poppy?
Hello, I'm in New Orleans.
Hi, Poppy.
What a place to eat. One of my favorite places to eat.
Great place to eat. Great place.
Well, Poppy, you wish you were here today because you really would have enjoyed our slow food breakfast here of local breads and local jams. It's been absolutely wonderful. Tell us what a Slow Food USA is. Do you guys know what Slow Food USA is?
Yes.
You do?
Slow
okay.
Food is an international movement, and so when we refer to the USA branch, this is one of now 85 countries in the world that is active in the pursuit of doing what our founder, Carlo Petrini, advises, to treasure and help perpetuate the pleasures of the table. And we do that by eating seasonal and local and valuing our farmers and working actively with all of our food producers as co-producers. That's one of Carlo's new concepts. And Michael, I have to tell you that I loved your introduction to the show, and I was so inspired by the story of your father. And to me, this encapsulates what we are doing with the slow food movement.
It really does. I mean, what precious bread
The things
that was, you know.
The things in our lives, the things that make us all human, really come down to our sense of taste and our sense of smell. And these are the most evocative things in our lives. And so I'm thrilled by the story of your dad. And I have to ask you, where did you come across the phrase, eat it to save it?
Well, to hear the answer to that, you're going to have to wait till we're finished with this first commercial break.
Okay.
Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're having a little fun today. We're doing part two of a two-part series on bread and jam, inspired mostly by a story in Tales from a Tin Can, which is an oral history of a World War II Navy destroyer. And today we have the jam side of the story. Last week we did bread, and today we're talking jam with the jam boys themselves, Eric Haberly and Philip Hong from We Love Jam. And also we have Poppy Tooker from Slow Food USA. And you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey, welcome back. Michael Olson here. This is The Food Chain. We're talking bread and jam, and boy, are we ever talking bread and jam today. We have a table full of homemade breads here with some stunning Blenheim apricot jams from the We Love Jam people, Eric Haberly, Phineas Hong, and also from New Orleans, we're talking with Poppy Tooker. Poppy, you asked an interesting question. Where did I first hear about Eat It to Save It? Well, I stole it from you, of course.
Okay.
But, you know,
I was so tickled because I just want to give you this last familial connection. It's that when I was a little girl, my great-grandmother was alive till I was 10, and she never, ever told me to clean my plate. Instead, she would say, "Poppy, eat it to save it." And through my slow food work, I'm now the chairman of the Slow Food Arc of Taste.
Mm-hmm.
That's really our mantra, because if we don't eat it, we're not going to create a market for it, and we're not going to save it. It's going to become extinct, whatever the food item is that we're referring to.
Well, you know where I heard of the same concept before was from one of the founders of Greenpeace, who suggested that if we want to save our forests, what we must do is chop down the trees and use them to build things with. Because if we use them, we'll want them, and we will husband them and grow them. And it's kind of the same thing that happened with hunters. In the Great Depression, much of the wildlife in America was cultivated. It was harvested. It was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And were it not for the hunters who organized themselves and started paying into funds, and to be able to hunt animals, you had to husband them,
mm-hmm.
and you had to cultivate them. So it's not a new concept, but it's a precious concept, is it not?
It sure is. And in getting ready to talk with you about apricots today, do you know that in Latin, apricot means precious?
Oh,
that's fascinating.
So here, Poppy, here we have two kids from Silicon Valley that somehow ran across an apricot tree, a Blenheim apricot tree, and somehow realized just how precious that tree was and started making jams fruit of that tree, and from that little tiny start grew a business, and now they're running around the country looking for people who have Blenheim orchards. And in that whole concept, eat it to save it, really what these young men are doing now are looking for people to plant apricot orchards, right?
Yep. Or if they have them, not to tear up the trees and plant something else, which is what we've encountered in this area.
And the reason you can do that is because people want your jam.
And apricots, the Blenheims, are really delicious.
Well, let's go quickly to the Blenheim. What happened to the Blenheim? In the year 1900, almost the Blenheim was the apricot.
In this area, the Blenheim was a major harvest, and it was used specifically for drying or for canning. And all of Silicon Valley was basically cherry and apricot orchards. And unfortunately, as we know, we all know what happened to Silicon Valley. Everybody wants to live there, and there's all kinds of shopping centers and office buildings. So Phineas grew up in the area, and you remember they've kind of disappeared one by one, right?
Yeah. Even when I was a kid, there were a lot of cherry orchards in the Cupertino area, and no longer.
No longer. What about the rest of the country, Poppy?
Well, what I know about the Blenheim, the Blenheim seems to be pretty identifiable in California, in central to northern California.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of isolated then.
Yeah, and so there, it's a lot of what we do with the Arc has to do with the terroir of the food.
Okay, let's stop right there.
Yeah.
First, the Arc.
The Arc. Well, we boarded the Blenheim apricot onto the Arc of Taste in 1999. It was one of the very first items that were welcomed onto the Ark.
Wow.
And this is a virtual Noah's Ark that was the brainchild of Slow Food founder Carlo Petrini, where we identify and nominate rare and endangered foods, such as the Blenheim, and then by boarding them onto the Ark, the criteria is they have to be of historical value to the place of their origin. They have to be endangered, but most of all, they have to taste good. You can't get on the Ark unless you're delicious. And so the Blenheim met all of those standards and became one of our very first things on the Ark, along with the Suncrest peach. That's a similar sort of situation. To my understanding, one of the big problems with the Blenheims commercially is they don't ship well. So jam is one of the perfect things to do with it, but my goodness, there's nothing quite like a fresh Blenheim.
Oh, they're unbelievable. The flavor, if you let them ripen on the tree and you eat them, it's unbelievable.
Well, I'll tell you a secret that I learned this spring, and it's just amazing the way life goes that I'd be talking to you all today about this, because I have some new friends out in your neck of the woods. Rick and Christy Knoll are very dear friends of mine, and I actually was at their farm the week that their Blenheims came into full production.
Ooh.
And Rick's philosophy about the best Blenheim is when you walk through his orchard and the tree says, this one's perfect right now, and let's go. And so the most perfect Blenheim is actually the one that you snatch up under the tree
before
the ants find it.
That's true. And and another thing is, the way we know they're ready is when the ants are crawling all over the tree on the fruit, because the fruit, when it's really ripe, the ants start to eat it.
Uh-huh.
So if it's on the ground or if there's ants on it, two things that are not appetizing, that is when it's at its peak flavor.
So essentially, the Blenheim lost out in the race to industrialize our food chain because it's not a good shipper. You can't pick it in California and send it to Tierra del Fuego.
And cheap imports. The dried industry was what they did with most Blenheims because of that reason. They tasted good and they dried them, and the cheap imports, mostly from Turkey, have outpriced a lot of these farmers, and they just can't compete. And so they either pull up the trees and plant something that's more profitable, or they sell their land.
And that's the way of a lot of agriculture. And you said one more word other than arc, and you said terroir. What do you mean by terroir, Poppy?
Well, you know, the Blenheims originally came from Europe. They were first grown there about 200 years ago, And Blenheim Palace is the birthplace of Winston Churchill. So it has a lot of European history tied to it. But a Blenheim apricot that you eat in England and one that you pick up underneath a tree at Knoll Farms is going to taste very, very different. And that's because of the terroir, because of the soil, because of the growing conditions and how the trees adapt themselves. And sort of a challenge that...
Which is just the same concept of wine, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That applies. As a matter of fact, those wacky Knolls, you know, they when they gave up their organic certification 4 years ago, they actually changed what they call their produce, and they call it terroir. Only they spell it phonetically, T-A-I-R-W-A, because Rick was worried that the French word might be too difficult for Americans to grab their brains around.
Well, you know, Daniel Leder, who we worked with last week, he's the author of Local Breads, talked about breads with the same concept of terroir. In traveling through Europe, you would go to a village. That village would make bread from the wheat or the grains that were grown in the neighborhood. And therefore, each bread reflected the geographical or the geography or the terroir of that community. So it was like the community's bread.
Another item from New Orleans that's on the Slow Food Arc of Taste is New Orleans French bread, the famous poor boy sandwich bread. It has been proven cannot be replicated any place. It can only be made in New Orleans.
Is it the water?
So it's something in the water, it's something in the air when it comes to bread making, but it is just as significant.
Okay, folks, quick break. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. Anything you want to know about the apricots, about jams and jellies, about breads, about foods, about slow food, pick up your phone. 831-4790, 479-1080, and 800-624-2665. Thank you. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about, what the heck are we talking about?
Apricots and bread.
Jams and jellies and apricots and local breads and local jams. And gosh, it's just literally a feast here in the studios today. We have about six different kinds of breads. We have some goat cheese. We have some organic butter. We have some Blenheim apricot jam from the We Love Jam guys.
Hello.
Right? Hello.
Eric Haberly, Phineas Hone, and also from New Orleans, Poppy Tugger, who is with the Slow Food USA people, right?
Yes.
So we were talking about the difference geography can make, and you're talking about how you have added a bread, a New Orleans bread, to the Slow Food Arc of Good Taste, and that you prove that you cannot grow this bread anyplace else.
No, you cannot absolutely make it anyplace else, and that was proved in the 1950s when one of the original baker of the New Orleans poor boy loaf, the John Gendusa family, some of the master bakers who had been working with the Gendusas for many, many years, decided to open up their own bakery just 60 miles upriver in Baton Rouge. And these guys knew the equipment, they knew the ingredients, they had been doing this their whole lives. They moved up to Baton Rouge, replicated the French bread bakery, tried for a whole year to make New Orleans French bread in Baton Rouge, and at the end of the year, they gave up and came back and went back to work for Mr. Gendusa because they could not make New Orleans French bread in Baton Rouge.
Eric, you had a comment about Naples.
Yes, we were in Naples. How many years ago was that?
I think two.
2 years ago. And so, of course, anybody who's been to Naples, you have to have the pizza because that's supposed to be the birthplace of pizza and it's supposed to be really, really good. And so we had some pizza, which... it was pretty unbelievable. Margarita, uh-huh. Is what they call it? And so the hotel we were staying in, we asked the guy, we were like, oh, we had the pizza. It's so good. And he goes, yes, you can only get it in Naples. He goes, I had a friend who moved up to London, and he had a pizza place here in Naples. He imported the flour. He had a buffalo mozzarella imported up there. He had the tomatoes, everything. And it tasted completely different. And he's like, do you know why? I'm like, no. He goes, it's the water. He goes, the water in this region tastes completely different than the water in London.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, that's basically, you can't make it anywhere else.
Well, you know, one of the key principles of industrialization is that you standardize a product so that what is a tomato in California will be a tomato in Moscow and so on. But this seems to be headed in just about the opposite direction, is it not?
I think so. I think
Thank goodness it is. And I'd like to give all of your listeners in California a personal challenge about the Blenheim. The jam guys are doing such a good job preserving the apricots. And obviously there's a lot of drying still going on. But in 1988, there were 32,000 tons of Blenheim produced in California. This year, the Blenheim crop is down to 2,000 tons. So it seems to me that the folks in California could get after those fresh apricots and eat every one of them. They don't have to be shipped anywhere, and anything that there is extra can be turned into jam, and there we save the apricot.
Yeah, you should, I mean, people should demand at their, you know, their grocery store. I mean, if we're in California, especially in the Bay Area, go to your Safeway and say, I want some Blenheims.
Yeah.
You know, order them, because they are grown here, and they have surplus, and they dry them. They have tons of fresh stuff, they just don't know what to do with it. Of course, we're willing to take it off their hands and turn it to jam.
So what is the expression, Poppy Tooker?
Eat it to save it.
Eat it to save it. Needed to save it. So how did you guys get into the business of jam making? Let's go quickly to that experience, because to me, to discover a tree and look at a tree and say, hey, let's make some jam. Mm-hmm. And then you all of a sudden you're in the jam business, and all of a sudden you've got a website and people are buying your jams now from all over the country.
All over the world,
so it's all over the world. Mm-hmm. So now that, which is definitely a local food, the Blenheim apricot, is can be enjoyed everywhere.
Yeah, and thousands of people know about the Blenheim now thanks to just us making the jam. I mean, I really have to give credit to Food & Wine magazine, because they're the ones who basically decide to write about us. Who writes about someone who makes 100 jars of jam a year from one tree in their backyard? That was crazy enough as it is. And they went for it, and I guess they thought it was a good story. And so
you made 100 jars of jam?
Normally it was about 100 jars of jam a year. It could be more depending on the yield. This year we had tons and tons of apricots. And so this was a good year. Last year it was horrible, because basically what happens with the apricots is if it rains and the blossoms, it'll ruin the blossoms. You don't get any fruit. Last year devastated a lot of the Blenheims.
In apricots, as in wine, you have vintage years.
Totally, sure. Yes. Every year, it's a different year, and we have jam that we haven't opened that goes back 4 or 5 years. We have it, it's like wine, and it's each year is a little bit different. And also, the fruit from our tree tastes slightly different from the fruit from other trees. Our tree, we didn't know, was really old. It's probably about 50 years old. And so, you know, if you go to an orchard, sometimes they have 10-year-old trees, sometimes they have 15-year-old trees, sometimes they have 50-year-old trees, and the fruit tastes different from tree to tree. I mean, it's incredible.
And you started selling. How did you start selling these things?
Well,
tell me about the transition.
It was never supposed to be a business. Phineas, why don't you explain?
It was never supposed to be a business. We just started making it for friends and family, because the tree was producing so much fruit, and it was such a shame for
the... Do you have a name for this tree, by the way? Have you named it yet?
No.
just a thought.
And it just became a way to sort of share this amazing fruit with people. Mm-hmm. And the business aspect really only started after the Food & Wine mention.
Yeah, we didn't think anybody was going to write about us. So when they said we were going to write about us, we were like, uh-oh, what are we going to do? And they asked us all these questions like, how are you going to sell it? And I had to think for a second. I'm like, oh, it'll be on a website. I mean, I hadn't even built it. And then they're like, well, is there going to be a waiting list? I'm like, sure, why not? You know, they basically answered all the questions for us. So the waiting list, when people started emailing us to get on the waiting list in February, you know, we got thousands of emails. And so we're like, what are we going to do? So that's when we started looking for the orchards. That's when we found out that the Blenheim was considered endangered by slow food. Mm-hmm. And when we started talking to orchard growers who basically were tearing up their trees, we were immediately on a mission. We had to save the Blenheim. It's just so we figured we could sell the stuff, we could buy it from farmers, we could give them a reason to grow it. And for example, the fruit that we bought for the second mailing list, we gave him 25% more than he asked for the price of the fruit. We said, and next year we're going to come back and we're going to buy more and we're going to pay you more money because we want you to stay in business. And we're that's basically our mission, mm-hmm. is to give them a reason to grow the fruit and we pay them more money.
Wow. So what did you tell Food and Wine Magazine? What was your email? What did you tell them?
I sent a press release, and I basically said we've been making this jam for 5 years. And the thing is, for the past 5 years, people are fanatical about this jam. Like, they were addicted. They're like, oh, I got to get another jar. I worked somewhere with this woman who, like, every couple months, she'd ask for another jar. And then when I said they were selling, she goes, oh, am I going to have to pay for it? I'm like, no, we will give you free jam each year. So we had a group of people who were really obsessed with the jam. And that's what prompted us to send the press release to Food and Wine. We never thought we would ever turn it into a business.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Pick up your phone and join us. We'll be right back.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor, you don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Well, yum. I'm here to tell you that we've had a feast today here on the Food Chain on local breads and local jams. And last week our show was about local bread, and this week about local jam. Local jam folks from We Love Jam, Eric Haberly and Phineas Hong, also Poppy Tooker from the Slow Food Convivium in New Orleans. You know, one of the things that really struck me about that story about my father on that ship up in the Bering Sea eating that freshly baked bread by that Amish baker on the up in the galley was that they take the bread down back down to the fire room and they take out their secret stash of butter and jam, and they shared it. And that must have been one of the most intimate dinners, you know, in the middle of the night and then on the Bering Sea. And that sharing that bread must have been just so intimate and so precious. And there is that about food, isn't there, Poppy Tooker?
Absolutely. And imagine if your father were to have a taste of the same flavor of jam now. The taste memories that would come back to him.
Well, you know, I suspect, Poppy, that they did not know how to make cheap food back then.
Right.
You know, the jams they made were probably real jams.
From backyard trees?
They were probably from orchards, commercial orchards, but I don't think they had industrialized things and learned how to make cheap food back then.
No, not yet. That really, really, really happened in great force after the Second World War, during and after, because food was such an issue then.
Well, go ahead.
I have something that I have to extend to everyone. If you are curious about the Blenheim, aside from having it in jam, some of the farmers also freeze them. Uh-huh. And because of its Ark of Taste status, the Blenheim is going to be featured as part of an Ark of Taste harvest dinner that I am hosting at Knoll Farms on Sunday, October 7th.
Ooh.
And being from New Orleans, you know, we are just all about cocktails. And last December, when Rick and Christy came and visited me in New Orleans, they brought bags of frozen Blenheims with them. And I have this sort of cocktail concoction that involves lavender and rosemary syrup with pureed Blenheim apricots and a goodly amount of tequila and triple sec.
Wow. I want some of that. We also know someone who makes Blenheim brandy.
Boy, I bet that's good. Mm-hmm.
So, Poppy, for the benefit of those people who do not live around where we are right now, where the food chain is heard around the country, the slow food movement has these dinners throughout the country. Do you not? I mean, you're not just located here and in New Orleans. No.
We've got actually now 150 convivium that are active across the United States. And so anybody who is interested in finding the group near them, because that's what the local chapters are called, convivium. It indicates what we do. We get together to have a convivial good time. We eat and drink, and we talk about eating and drinking, and we do good work while we're doing all that fun. And so they can go online to slowfoodusa.org and find the convivium closest to them.
Good. Let's go quickly to Jan. Jan, welcome to the food chain.
Hi. Interesting program. I was just talking to one of my brothers recently, excuse me, and reminiscing about growing up in the Santa Clara Valley when it was called the Fruit Basket of the World.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We were a mile away from the school, and there was only one, two, three other streets around. All the rest was orchard. And my brother, gradually as people moved in, they would divide up these apricot and cherry orchards and put houses. Well, a lot of the people didn't use the fruit, so he had gone down to the unemployment agency and asked for work, and they didn't have anything right then. But he decided that he'd do a business where he went to the people, put out notices and everything that he would buy the fruit from them. And a lot of them just called up and said, "Take it. We don't want any money for it. Just do something with it." And before you knew it, he was back in the unemployment office, saying, "I need pickers and I need, so-and-so." And the people, the farmers out there, Cavillo, Jurevich, Vitovich, Smith, one gave them the ladders, another gave them the trays, buckets from another, and another guy let him dry them in his orchard. And they were just little trees so, he could get the sun. And they helped him, and Mariani's bought every bit of it from him that he wanted to sell. And he employed a bunch of people, and had a successful trip and saved all those Blenheim apricots.
So if you want to save it, you have to eat it, right?
Right. And what we used to do, since we had a place with about 20 of them, my dad used to work in a cannery for a little while, and he had one of the canning and juicers, big juicer, and we used to juice them and can them in cans and store them in the garage. And, the rest of the year we'd go in there and get a can of apricot juice and sit it down, and it was nectar of the gods.
The juice sounds amazing. I've never had the juice.
Oh, it was nectar of the gods. And I just saw Mr. Jurevich down at the farmer's market in Felton, and I got some of his cherries earlier.
Uh-huh.
I made some brandy cherries. Just throw the cherries in the jar and fill it with brandy, and you put them on the shelf for a while.
Good story.
Delicious.
Good story. Okay, thank you for the call, Jan. Really appreciate it. Well, folks, this is Michael Olson. Today we're talking about jams, jellies. What's the difference between jams and jellies?
Jellies are clear. They don't have any pieces of fruit in them.
Uh-huh.
And jam and preserves can have a particular matter.
Love that particular matter.
Yeah, it sounds so scientific.
What do you think out there? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Please do stay tuned. Well, have you ever tasted a Blenheim apricot? I have this morning, and they are stunning. I mean, they just make you go just like that. And we are talking apricots, Blenheim apricots. We've got Eric Haberly and Phineas Hong, who are the co-founders of WeLoveJam.com. And how do we get in touch with you, by the way?
Our website, WeLoveJam.com.
And that's how people can taste the Blenheim apricot.
Mm-hmm.
WeLoveJam.com. Also, Poppy Tooker, who is the chairman, I guess, of the Slow Food Arc of Good Taste and a member of the Slow Food Convivium of New Orleans. Let me ask you this, Poppy Tooker. Why should we save the Blenheim apricot?
Because it's undisputably one of the most delicious fruits of California. And so it tastes good. It's beautiful. It's good for you. And the best should always be saved. So
even though it doesn't fit into the industrialized food chain where you pick something here and send it over there and...
Well, I'll tell you, one of the most important work that I'm involved in New Orleans right now is bringing a return to urban farming to the south shore of Lake Pontchartrain, to these large, large areas that were so devastated and are not being rebuilt.
Uh-huh.
And consequently, I believe we are going to be shortly here ahead of the green food chain in the rest of the country, because by doing this work in this microclimate, which is superior to the growing areas on the North Shore and where the traditional farming was before the 1950s, we are going to ensure a secure food shed for our children and our grandchildren. And so I know I'm preaching to the choir, to the folks in California, but as that urban sprawl continues to uproot the orchards, people have got to look to eating at home, to coming home to eat, like Gary Nabin says, and sourcing their food locally.
And one of the great things is with the jam that we're doing is we don't have to worry about the perishability of the fruit, which is one of the susceptible factors of this fruit. It bruises easily. Is that we buy it, we make it into really great jam, and we have people all around the world who can order it. So if you go to welovejam.com, you can order it. You can be anywhere in the world, and we'll send it to you.
But certainly, if you can get a fresh Blenheim, please do.
Okay. Let's go quickly. Marcia, welcome to the food chain.
Hello. I just have a quick question. I wanted to know if there's any way I can tell if the apricot tree that I have in my backyard is a Blenheim, because I made 50 jars of jam from the fruit this year, and last year there wasn't much on there. It's like every other year, and this stuff is so delicious, and I didn't waste one apricot, you'll be glad to know.
We're going to have to come and taste it and see.
Okay. And it was so delicious and so sweet, I hardly had to add any sugar at all.
Well, the Blenheims, they have a...
Thank you, Marcia. Go ahead.
Oh, the Blenheims have a characteristic red blush on one side. That's one of the things that, and they're quite small.
And also, if you take it to a fruit expert, the leaf, they can identify it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to John. John, welcome to the food chain. Okay, let me ask you two. We have 2 minutes left. Mm-hmm. Why should we save the Blenheim when other apricots fit better into that industrialized food chain?
Well, the Blenheim is local to this area, and there's farmers who still make a living growing this fruit. And we really think that in where you live that there should be local farms where you can buy your food. And not only does the Blenheim taste amazing, but basically it's part of the tradition of this area, and it's something that really we cannot lose.
Phineas?
Well, it definitely is a fruit with a long history, and certainly with any great food, it tastes amazing, and if it can convert apricot haters like us, then it should be saved.
Well, Poppy Tooker, what about those of us who live in the rest of the United States and where there are lots of local foods? You know, I was raised in Montana, and we had choke cherries there.
Well, you can go online to slowfoodusa.org and click on the Arc of Taste, and a whole list of foods that cover all regions of the United States come up. And so people can identify some things that are precious in their own backyards. And I would just, again, really like to urge anybody who's interested and in the Northern California area to consider coming over and drinking a Blenheim with me on Sunday, October 7th at the Harvest Dinner. Rick's been growing out fields full of endangered Arc of Taste fruits and vegetables.
Okay, we'll definitely be there. John, you've got 30 seconds. Go ahead, quickly.
So, John?
Yes, you're there.
Hi, okay,
John.
Yes, I'm from Santa Clara Valley. I'm 80 years old, and Blenheim apricot has been very, very popular, and it dries very well. Now, there's other varieties, like the Moorpark apricot.
Which we've heard of.
Ancient variety, and another cousin to that one is called the Alameda Hemskirt, and there's not many old trees left.
John, we have to go, but producing. Thank you so much for the call, folks. This has been the food chain. Oh, too much fun!
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.